Hello, I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and friends for making your lives easier. This evening, we are going to be talking about a rather heavy subject, but one that I think is socially significant. It's going to be on sexual assault, help, and healing. Tonight, we have a special guest who is Erin Garibaldi. She is a former rape and certified sexual assault counselor with the Santa Barbara Rape Crisis Center. And also, to begin the show, if you have any issues that you're dealing with around sexual assault or rape or molestation, we urge you to get some counseling as soon as you can. Either contact your local rape crisis center near you or RAIN, R-A-I-N-N, at 800-656-HOPE, and that's 800-656-4673. We will be giving that number out throughout the show this evening. Good evening, Erin. How are you?
Good evening, Julianne. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience at the Santa Barbara Rape Crisis Center?
Sure. So I worked at the center for about 2 years, providing individual, group, and family counseling for survivors of sexual assault. And I worked on the 24-hour hotline, as well as helping with the forensics exams and doing some individual long-term counseling for clients.
And then how long did you do that work?
I was there for about 2 years.
Okay. During your time there, I'm sure you had a lot of questions as to what is the difference between rape, sexual assault, molestation, and incest.
Absolutely. It happens a lot. And basically, one of the easiest definitions for rape is any kind of sexual interaction that you don't want. And it can be either any kind of penetration with a penis or any foreign object. So that can be dildo, fingers, anything like that. And so it's unwanted, and the victim or the survivor doesn't actually have to say no to the assault. If it's unwanted at any point during this interaction, it becomes rape. And so with incest, it's similar in some ways to rape, but it's usually involving an immediate family member. So that's usually like a parent, an aunt, an uncle, cousin, brother, sister, someone like that. And then, any kind of sexual abuse can also be any kind of kissing or touching or anything that, again, is unwanted by the survivor. And so it's all, anything that's unwanted or not appreciated, basically, is considered assault.
Okay, so it sounds like it covers a wide array of unwanted touching and physical force, correct?
Yes, and it can also sometimes be verbal. So if someone like keeps on making a lot of sexual comments towards you, that's a form of harassment and abuse.
Okay, that's good information to know, because a lot of people, I think, would not consider that within the sexual assault realm. So that's good to have that information also. It's unwanted, and it makes the victim feel uncomfortable, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Anything that's uncomfortable and unappreciated or unwanted is in that realm of something that, like, a rape crisis center or any other kind of abuse center can help some survivors with.
Okay, I'm going to backtrack just a tad bit here with some statistics from RAIN that I found off the internet, and which anybody can pull up. 44% of the victims are under age 18. 80% are under age 30.
Mm-hmm.
Every 107 seconds, another American is sexually assaulted. Each year, there are about 293,000 victims of sexual assault. 68% of sexual assaults are not reported to the police, but the 98% of the rapists will never spend a day in jail or prison. And that was an astounding rate to me. That was unbelievable. Yes. And approximately 2/3 of the assaults are committed by someone known to the victim, and 38% of rapists are a friend or an acquaintance. So,
and so it's like most people, when they think of rape, think of like someone jumping out of the bush and attacking you right there. But like you said, most are actually known by the survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's usually like a friend, a family member, a relative, a neighbor. And like that's what makes it like really scary to think about, that it could happen. And it usually does happen with someone you know.
Yes, it does. And it happens more often than we know because of so many of these assaults being unreported and hidden, and the victim walking around and trying to deal with the after effects of being assaulted. Can you talk about some of the after effects?
Sure. So each survivor kind of has a different response to an assault. So there is no, if I see this, this person must have been raped. It, you can be upset, angry, anxious, unable to sleep, unable to eat. You can be promiscuous. You can be completely celibate. And there's actually statistics saying about between 50 and 95% of survivors develop post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it's this constant reliving of what happened to you and just this constant feeling of fear that it'll happen again or someone behind you might attack you. And that's usually what is most upsetting for survivors, is just this constant feeling of being on edge and just waiting for the next one to happen.
So when you had survivors, and I do want to go over that with you too, survivors versus victims, because I think that wording is really important. A lot of people afterwards feel like they're victims, and they will take that role and they will take it out with them for sometimes the rest of their lives. So I think it's important to differentiate between victims and survivors. I call them survivors, period.
Yeah, absolutely. Because basically, as you're kind of saying, like, if you own that victim identity, it kind of leaves you stuck there, where it's, I'm always this weak person, I can never get past this. But the reason that, like, I use survivor, and you use it as well, is that it's, you survived a hell that most people can't even imagine. And you got through it, and now you're on the other side. And now the work is, how do we keep helping you and keep helping you live and own that survivor role and become the stronger person that you were before this happened, and you will be again once you kind of integrate this new identity as a survivor.
Mm-hmm. So what type of work would you do when a survivor would come in to see you at the center?
So that's a hard question to ask, just because there is so many different levels of what a survivor needs. Some need to go blow by blow of what happened, and some just want to completely ignore, you know, not ignore, but not sit there and process that. They would rather just, you know, what do I do about it now? And so, like, the first step is to try to figure out what exactly the survivor needs. Do they need to go through everything that happened to kind of move past it? Or do they just need to work on, okay, now I'm feeling uncomfortable in my relationship afterwards. How do I move forward with that? How do I talk to my partner about being uncomfortable having sex now? And so it would be then working on whatever issues that the survivor has afterwards. So it might be anger issues where they're kind of lashing out at their friends and family, or like I said, relationship problems, or it could be like eating disorders that might develop afterwards, and working through what exactly is triggering that feeling and that need to kind of act out in some way.
And then sometimes also it's immediate needs, housing, safety issues. Where is the perpetrator? Has the perpetrator been jailed, or are they out and free?
Exactly. Yeah. So like at the center, we had kind of two different levels of counselors. So there was the crisis counselors, which were the ones that right after the assault, up to about 6 months to a year after the assault, were kind of just working on the daily, you know, how do I get through the day? What do I do next? Where is the survivor? How do I accept where he's at, or she, depending on what who assaulted you? And then there was the long-term counselors, which are kind of a year on after the assault. And, like, how do I keep moving? How do I keep this progress going? And how do I kind of get back to living again and not staying in that terrified spot for the rest of your life?
Right. Isn't a lot of it trying to get back to a, quote, normal, unquote, life as soon as possible?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's getting back to your daily routines, like not being afraid to walk down the street or having to have the bat next to your bed at night, and just kind of going back to your life without constantly having that thought in your head.
Right. So why do you think that there is a hesitancy to report being sexually assaulted?
Well, there's some statistics basically saying that 23% of people who don't report give it personal reasons why they don't. And so usually that means, you know, like we were saying, that about 80% know their perpetrator. And so if you know the person that did it, like a family member, you know, I don't want my dad to go to jail. I don't want my uncle to have to go through that. I don't want my family to judge me based off of what someone else did. And same thing with friends. Like, I don't want my friend to have that carried around with them for the rest of their life. And so it's this kind of idea of, I don't want to deal with this on their end, and I don't want to have to talk to the police. I don't want to have to go through the report and just having to relive that over and over again. And I just don't want to deal with it. If I can just not report it, then it's almost like it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, it did happen. And usually if you don't report, there is kind of this build up of that emotion of, I'm so afraid. This isn't resolved. There isn't any kind of closure. And in some ways, that helps build that victim mentality.
Right. And then it definitely, right. And it gets a person locked into that flight mode.
Exactly. And part of it, too, is, again, get into that space of, because you're not reporting and you're not sharing, it's harder to go to, like, a rape crisis center or call RAIN, like you recommended earlier, because then you would have to admit it happened.
And so
it builds up more of that shame and guilt about something that is not your fault. Usually rapes happen because the perpetrator feels this need to have power over someone. And that for some reason they thought the victim was the perfect person to go ahead and have power over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's never about the victim. It's never, like, there's this belief that it's, like, for example, like, a woman was wearing revealing clothing while she, you know, she asked for it. And it's not that at all. It's the perpetrator needed to feel better about themselves. And it's never about your sexuality as, like, being provocative or any way. It's all power, and that's it.
Right, and it's an act of violence.
Absolutely.
Number one. And it's also, you know, part of the perpetrator mentality. Can you get into that a little bit?
Sure. So part of that mentality is this idea that almost they have a right to claim power over someone. And they feel powerless in other areas of their life, so they figure, I'm just going to take this power. I'm going to take someone's body and just use it for my own good. And it's a lot of times they don't think of the consequences of how it's impacting someone else and how it can damage someone, and it can be irreversible if they don't get the help they need. And, you know, it's perpetrators need help as well. I'll admit I don't have as much experience with that, so I don't exactly know what could be done to help them, but they also need help. Because this is definitely a lifelong problem for them if they don't get this issue addressed of feeling powerless and needing that control over another human being.
Yeah, and then the statistics also support that perpetrators have more than one victim. In fact, there were some statistics I saw not too long ago that the average perpetrator has about 100 victims. I don't know how true that is. I hope that's not true, but that was pretty shocking to see that statistic.
Yeah. And part of that is because they never get caught if no one reports. It's that kind of that, oh, I did this once, and it's okay. No one reported, no one complained, no one said anything. So it's like, oh, why not try it again? I need more power. Let's do it again. And that's what makes it really scary.
Yeah, it does. And I think that makes it even more important to somehow report this. And Aaron, after the break, we are going to be talking about the anonymity laws or the rules in California and how people can report easier. And I do also want to mention again, if you are listening to this podcast and this has happened to you or one of your family or friends, please contact a local rape crisis center or RAINN, RAINN, at 800-656-4673. And we're going to be taking a break and come right back.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. This is Julianne Good and Aaron Garibaldi, and we are talking this evening about sexual assault, help, and healing. As we were on the break, we were discussing what in California is called an anonymous report versus a full report. Can you explain a little bit about what that is, Aaron?
So basically in California and a couple of other states, if you're considering possibly having this option, RAINN.org, that's RAINN.org, has a listing of kind of what states allow this to happen. And so basically anonymous reporting is, if you choose to, you can basically send in some paperwork to the police department saying, this person assaulted me on this date, this is what happened, and it basically goes into a file. And so it's not prosecuted. The police don't know your name. Your name is never attached to it. But this file becomes attached to the perpetrator's name. And so basically, if this perpetrator ever commits another assault, and let's say that survivor says, I'm going to prosecute, your report becomes part of their story as well, saying that, again, this person has done it now twice. And like we were talking about before the break, there was that statistic you saw that a perpetrator can do it up to 100 times. And so if we have this anonymous report, at least we can stop the perpetrator after two, rather than letting them keep on perpetrating against other survivors.
Right. Hopefully it puts the brakes or the perpetrator gets help, period. That would be the best case scenario. That's not always the case, but there are programs out there now for perpetrators. They're starting to grow, which is great because, as you had mentioned, Aaron, they also need help. A lot of the perpetrators are former, maybe even childhood abuse victims themselves. And then they start, you know, doing this cycle of turning around and creating victims. So it's really important to, you know, do something like this, at least get the ball rolling with stopping and starting to heal, and, you know, versus what so many people do is just after the assault, they go into, you know, one of many mental states that are survival mode. And as you had mentioned before, that sometimes that's the dysfunctional behaviors that happen right afterwards. And then the the survivor at that point thinks that he or she's probably going crazy or just questioning reality to begin with after a trauma like that happens. So can you talk about some of the dysfunctional behaviors that may occur after an assault happens?
Well, we briefly hit on them, but there's usually kind of this period of like depression or anger where it's, I want to lash out at this person who did this to me or lash out against myself for not speaking up or saying no or somehow figuring out a way to stop him or her, I guess. But, and then there's also just this dissociative kind of period where it's, I'm just going to step away. I'm not going to be involved and kind of triggered by what happened, so I'm not going to talk about it. Or when it does come up in any way, I just pull away. I go in. I don't want to look at it. I don't want to experience it again. So, like, that kind of happens a lot when, like, say the survivor's partner wants to initiate sex afterwards. Not immediately after, but any time afterwards. And the survivor will usually just kind of, their body will still be there, but their mind will be miles away. Where this is happening to me, but I'm not going to feel it. I'm not going to be responding to it. It's just, it's happening. And a lot of survivors do that during the assault just to protect themselves.
Disassociate.
Yeah. And so, like, this way they can not be there, not feel it themselves, not experience it. But the problem with that eventually does come where you're doing that in your regular life as well. Where it's like if anyone talks about sexual assault afterwards, you dissociate. You have any kind of intimate contact with a partner, you pull away again. And so it's healthy when it happens, like during the assault, but afterwards is the problem where you have to start like talking to a counselor to break that cycle where you can still go back to enjoying intimate experiences with a partner. Because not all of them are that dangerous, unsafe experience, like you experienced during a rape.
Mm-hmm. It is a process, and to have a supportive partner with you going through this process and understanding what the normal behaviors are afterwards, I think is really helpful.
Absolutely. So, like, a lot of rape crisis centers will offer, like, couples counseling to help explain, like, this is what's happening when she kind of blanks out, like, gets that blank stare on her face and isn't really responsive. Or this is what happens when she's first yelling at you or crying or and you don't know why. And so kind of build this kind of trust again with the partner, like, she's, you know, going through this and how can you help her kind of reconnect, get back to you, feel safe. And, like, that's the primary goal of a rape crisis center is to help a survivor get through it and feel safe in all their daily interactions with anyone.
Right. And we also want to emphasize, too, that survivors can be male or female. So, and some of the statistics, again, off of RAIN is that in 2003, one in every 10 rape victims were male.
Mm-hmm.
And that 2.78 million men in the U.S. have been victims of sexual assault or rape. So it's a very real thing for both sexes.
And the numbers for males are harder to predict as well because men are actually less likely to report than women are.
Yes.
And so we have this number of 1 in 10, but it can be much higher. It could be the same, like the number of women is 1 in 5. It could be closer to that, but the numbers are so underreported that we just don't know.
Yeah, I agree. That's more highly underreported, and I have known male survivors, so it's a very real situation.
Absolutely. And usually when a male is assaulted, it's usually done by another heterosexual male. And one question we always would get all the time was, if a male raped me as another male, would that make me gay? And absolutely not.
No.
Again, that was unwanted. Even if you had an erection, that does not mean you wanted what was happening. It's very common for males to develop an erection out of fear. And so do not doubt your sexuality because another male chose to, again, have power over you in that moment. That does not change who you are and what your orientation is.
Exactly. Thank you for pointing that out, Erin. I also want to mention some of the after effects of sexual assault, and that survivors are 3 times more likely to suffer from depression, 6 times more likely to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, 13 times more likely to abuse alcohol, 20 times more likely to abuse drugs, and 4 times more likely to contemplate suicide. So this is a very serious situation. And again, I want to mention that if you are listening to this podcast and this is bringing up memories for you or something that you're dealing with in the present situation, you, your family, or your friends, please contact your local rape crisis center or RAINN, R-A-I-N-N, at 800-656-4673. So, Erin, what else can you bring up as for a typical course for a survivor to be taking afterwards?
Like I said, survivors take their own course. I know that doesn't really help much answer that question because it is so varied. And the best thing you can do as like a friend or a relative is just believe your survivor. So many people are going to start doubting what happened. Like, I'll just bring up the Bill Cosby story, where so many people are now doubting these women that are coming forward because, well, so famous. Why would he? And that's what makes it so hard for survivors to come forward and share their stories, is because so many people afterwards doubt. Because, you know, he was a great guy. He is a great guy, and he would never, ever think of that. But as we were saying about the statistics, most often it's someone you know. It's someone you trust. And part of the appeal for the perpetrator is, this person trusts me so I can have power. And so, like I said, the first thing you can do is just believe and be supportive.
Yes, and just be there and just listen to them. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what to say at the time, just listen. And just maybe, you know, tell them it's going to be okay, and you're gonna help them find some assistance to get them through. That I think is one of the most powerful things you can do for a rape survivor, is just be there. Just, and as you said, Erin, believe them. And I want to mention too, you had mentioned something about Bill Cosby. So I think the whole concept of a lot of the perpetrators is they have this public persona because everybody loved Bill Cosby. Who could be funnier? And, you know, the whole TV history. And then he's got this other side to him, this dark side that only a few people knew about. So I think that is really typical perpetrator behavior. They know how to manipulate. They know how to groom who they are going to assault. They Absolutely. Have an absolute stalking mentality of finding who's going to be their easiest target for the most part.
Because it's rarely, extremely rarely, just kind of this unplanned event. In most cases, it is on some level, I wonder if I could do this. I wonder if I could take advantage of this person. I wonder if this will be allowed and will I get caught? And even in some kind of party situation, people do tend to have this idea, well, maybe if something happens, if I find, you know, the drunk girl. Mm-hmm. I'll be able to have sex tonight, or, you know, whatever the reasoning is behind the thought. But in some way, it's still planned. It's still the idea of, I will find the drunkest girl at the party where I believe she, you know, she can't physically say no, so therefore it's okay. But when you're drunk or high or incapacitated, you have no ability to consent or say no. And so just the rule of thumb is if they can't consent, don't do it. That most likely is unwanted.
Right. No means no.
Absolutely. I mean, even if you can't say no. Like there's a bunch of colleges right now are doing these campaigns of rather than no means no, of saying yes means yes.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, if a survivor can't say no for whatever reason, that they have to actually say yes rather than saying no.
Mm-hmm.
And that way there is no questioning of, well, they never said no, so therefore it was okay. And this way it's, you have to say yes before it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it definitely has been in the news lately in the East Coast cases. So it's good that that we're starting to talk about this again. I mean, the numbers are out there. This is even though, according to the RAIN site, sexual assaults have gone down by 50%. It's still happening. So we need to talk more about this, and hopefully going to have more avenues to make it comfortable and safe for the survivors to come out and start getting some help.
Yes. Because part of the problem is we're still shaming the survivors, where it's, you should have done something, you should have worn that, you should have said something, you shouldn't have been there that night, you should have stopped drinking. You know, it's this constant berating against the survivor when it should be turned to, you shouldn't assault people.
Right. Yeah, that's what it basically boils down to.
And so change that conversation, that number is still going to be hard to go down.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely going to have to be more talk and more education on this to lower the levels and hopefully make it stop altogether. I mean, that would be utopian. It would just be unbelievable. So hopefully we get the word out there. And again, if you are listening to this podcast and you are dealing with sexual assault issues yourself, please call your nearest rape crisis center or call RAIN, R-A-I-N-N, at 800-656-4673 and get some assistance. Even if you just make that call and say, this is what happened to me and I would really like somebody to just listen to me so I can tell my story. Whatever you want to say, you don't have to tell the whole story over and over and over again. Whatever you need to say to help yourself get to some stable ground so that you can move forward and that you're not stuck in this trauma for the rest of your life is so incredibly important. We are going to take a break. And we will be back with Erin Garibaldi.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
Thank you.
to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Aaron Garibaldi. We are talking about sexual assault, help and healing this evening. And Aaron, can you talk a little bit about if a person has been sexually assaulted and then they go to the emergency room, what is the forensic exam like and the role of an advocate in the emergency room?
Sure. So depending on what county you're in, some exams will be done in the emergency room and some will actually be done in an off-site location. So in Santa Barbara, it was done in an off-site location where basically it allowed the survivor to have a little more privacy. There's weren't in the emergency room dealing with all sorts of people walking by as you're sharing your story. That's becoming more common now to have an off-site location, but there are some counties that do still have the survivor go to the emergency room. And so basically wherever you end up having to do your forensic exam, what happens is the police officers will usually come in and do kind of a questioning of what happened. Usually you'll have your forensic nurse there and your advocate there as well. And so basically the police officer will kind of have you do a rundown of what happened. And these questions can be really upsetting for survivors just because they are explicitly what happened first, what happened second, where did the perpetrator touch you, what happened next. So it can be pretty triggering. And so what the advocate usually does during the questioning is kind of checking in with the survivor, making sure she or he is still okay. And so they'll be the one saying, hey, do you need a break now? Do you need to go get some water? Do you need to smoke? Whatever it is, to try to make sure the survivor kind of stops being triggered if that's what's going on with them. And because the police are trained to ask the questions, get the information to prosecute. And so that's their main goal. And the nurse is there to get as much information as they can about what they need to look for, like physically, on the survivor. And so they're kind of focused on their end of what they need to do. And so the advocate's there to focus on the survivor, making sure the survivor's okay and making sure they're not becoming too upset by what's happening. It's a pretty traumatic process. And so the advocate's there to make sure it's not any more traumatic as it has to be. And so once the questioning is done by the police officer, then you have the actual forensic exam. And so that's the one where the nurse goes in, basically does a pelvic exam to look for any evidence. So that's any herring in the vagina or anus, depending on what the survivor said was penetrated, looking for any bruising. If the survivor said she or he scratched the perpetrator, they're looking for skin cells. And basically, if they ejaculated, it's where did the ejaculation happen, and trying to find any sperm. And basically, if we can find any of that kind of physical evidence, that's going to build a stronger case against the perpetrator. And again, your advocate can be there for that exam. Usually advocates will ask, okay, you know, ask the survivor, do you want me there for the exam? And so if the survivor does, they can say, yes, come in, or no. And so if your advocate can be there to help direct you, again, because it's very physically upsetting. There's someone going over your entire body trying to just dig and scrape. And so having someone there starting some counseling sessions or even telling jokes to get your mind off of what's happening is a great help. And usually, again, if you're concerned about having someone watching this, usually the advocate and the nurse will make sure the advocate's in a location where they can't see what's going on. And they're just focused on your face rather than what's happening behind the curtain. So again, that way you're not having to expose yourself to another person.
Right. What about having like a friend or family member or something there during the process for support? Is that common?
Usually, again, it's a lot of survivors don't want their family to have to listen to what happened. So sometimes we will have family like out in the waiting room. So if the survivor needs a break, then it's like, okay, why don't you go, you know, talk to your mom for a bit or whoever's with them to kind of keep them calm. But during the exam, it's usually the advocates there to kind of be that support. So a lot of survivors feel shame right after the assault. So it's like they usually don't want family members or friends or anybody near to kind of see what happened. And so this way they're getting that support, but it's from someone who doesn't really know them outside. So it's like that way it's not as shameful to have someone hear what happened mm-hmm. and see what they're going through.
So it's somebody who is trained to care and knows how to give the right support, because it's so important right after the assault to have somebody there that can understands what the process is and can
absolutely,
just be there for you. Correct. Yeah.
And so like before your advocate will even be in the room with you, they have to go through a very intensive training and become state certified before they're even allowed to be part of the exam. So this way it's a person that's been trained, knows the common experiences of a survivor, and just kind of what to expect and how to help you through the whole process. It's not some random person off the street. It's someone who truly understands on some level what you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And if for some reason you don't have an advocate there, you absolutely have every right to talk to a police officer and demand that an advocate be there. Again, this varies by state, but in California, it's actually mandated that your advocate is there. The police officers are told that they need to call the Rape Crisis Center and let them know, hey, I need an advocate over here right now. And an advocate will be there. Some departments are better at this than others, but you absolutely have every right to demand that your advocate be there.
That's a good service. And I'm sure a lot of people don't know that they have that right. And, you know, when a survivor feels so out of control at that moment and it's getting questions asked all over the place, it's nice to be able to say, but I need this, I want that, you know, and to have those options available is really powerful.
Absolutely. And the police are very focused on getting the survivor to report, getting that to the point of prosecution. And so your advocate usually can also be there to make sure the survivor's needs are met and wants. So if, like, she doesn't or he doesn't want the report made, they can also remind the police officer, hey, there's also this anonymous reporting. Like, there is this other option where the name doesn't have to be attached. Why don't we talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
and
that's...
So it's,
go ahead.
It's a complicated process, but, you know, that's what advocates are there for, is to make sure the survivor gets as much information as possible and that they're not kind of pushed into something they may not necessarily want. I mean, ideally, we want everyone to report, so obviously this doesn't happen again to another person, but for whatever reason, if that's not what the survivor wants, you know, we need to listen to them.
Right.
We need to make sure the survivor kind of takes more power back and makes that choice rather than having it made for them again.
Exactly. That's one of the most important things to instill within a survivor is you have the choice to make up your mind. How do you want this course to be laid out in front of you? Because, you know, their power was taken away temporarily, but it's temporary. And as you had mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, Aaron, you know, there's ways to work through these events so that it does not take over one's life, so that they can, the survivors can take back their lives and make their lives stronger going forward. So it's just, it just ends up to be hopefully just another event in their life. It's something, yes, traumatic that happens, but it will not be with them for every day of their lives. That's why it's so important to get the help.
Defining experience.
Exactly.
Yes, survivor has to kind of integrate survivorship into who they are, but it's not entirely who they are. Because at the end of the day, you're still you. It's just now there's this new piece. And part of what counseling does is kind of help you identify what this piece is and figure out how big of a role it's going to play in your life. So for some survivors, it's something that's not, pretty much non-existent in their life, where they're able to just put it in this nice little corner and not, you know, really have to think about it every day. And some survivors, they want it to be a big part of their life where they go out and actually speak about it and help encourage people to, like, go for counseling and go for help if it happens to them and just be that voice of you're not alone.
Right. Yeah, and there are many events during the year, especially at college campuses, that will address sexual assault and getting assistance for it and speaking out and getting empowered again.
That's the biggest hurdle for a lot of survivors is their power and their strength is taken away for that 5-10 minutes. And you have a choice of either letting that overcome your life and be your life, or like we've kind of been talking about, and like getting back on your feet again, being stronger from it and moving on.
So can you talk about some of the ways that survivors can take back their power, you know, besides going to counseling and maybe support groups, and what other things can they start incorporating into their lives to help them gain their lives back?
Well, I know one thing at the Rape Crisis Center we provided was self-defense classes and kind of building up that belief of if something should happen to me again, I have the tools to stop someone from hurting me. And I would also teach my clients assertiveness training where they can sit there and say, have that power to say, no, this is what I want, and this, what you're saying, what you're doing is not what I want. A lot of people get assertive and aggressive confused. And as women, we're told, don't be aggressive. You know, stay calm and nice and friendly. But assertiveness is saying you can still set your boundaries and set your goals and say it in a way that people can hear you and understand it and respect it. Because that's one thing survivors kind of lose is this ability to say, this is what I want. This is okay. This is not okay. And so a lot of it is learning to kind of trust yourself again and kind of learning how to trust your intuition of this is not a safe place for me to be in, or this is not a safe person, or even like this feels good, so I'm going to keep doing this. And that it's okay to feel good. It's great. You should feel good.
Exactly. I think that's really important after an assault too, is that you need to incorporate the goodness in life and learning to trust people again, because not everybody is a perpetrator, thankfully. So going out and learning to enjoy even little things on a daily basis.
It's huge, because a lot of survivors tend to kind of, once after an assault happens, tend to withdraw. Just, I'm going to stay in my room. My room, I know, is safe. And so it's just kind of, I'm going to pull away from life just because I need to keep myself safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would regularly, you know, find out what our clients used to enjoy before the assault. So it's like someone would walk on the beach, and so it was like, okay, you know, for homework, take a walk on the beach, even if it's 5 minutes, get back to your life. Get back to enjoying everything you used to enjoy, because nothing about that has changed because of this incident.
Yeah, and it's
again,
important.
You're still who you were before you were assaulted. It's just there's this new piece that we need to kind of find a home for.
Yeah, self-care. Daily self-care. Yeah. As we're wrapping up, Erin, can you talk about some of the centers and support that there's out there in the communities that people can find?
So each center kind of offers their own program, but usually it does include individual counseling, family counseling, couples counseling, group counseling, where, again, it's other survivors getting together and talking about what happened and then also how they're moving past it. And so if you've been assaulted, I absolutely encourage you to call your local rape crisis center, call RAIN, and just ask for that help, because you're not alone. There are, unfortunately, plenty of people who have been through what you've been through, and it is not a sign of weakness. You've not done anything wrong. And absolutely get help, talk to someone, because as soon as you do, it does get better. You're not alone, and you don't have to suffer alone.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much, Erin. And if the listeners would like to contact you, how can they do so?
Sure. They can contact me by email. That's Erin, E-R-I-N, at NorouzClinic.com. And so that's N-O-R-O-O-Z, and then clinic, C-L-I-N-I-C.com. And I'm more than willing to help you just have someone to talk to or just have that connection, because, again, you're not alone.
Yes,
and unfortunately, rape makes you feel alone. And so please, by all means, reach out to someone, anyone, friends, family, a crisis center, me, whoever, and don't sit there alone. That's the hardest part about this, is that act makes you feel alone, but you're not.
Exactly. There's so many people to support you through the process of healing. Thank you so much, Erin Garibaldi. You were a great guest, yes. And thank you for joining us this evening on Psych 1-on-1. Again, the information for RAIN is 800-656-4273 or H-O-P-E. If you need assistance, please, by all means, call up, reach out. You don't have to be in this healing process by yourself. You are powerful, and you can heal from being assaulted. Thank you so much. This has been Julianne Good. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.